I am Bonneau Ansley, an active real estate agent and founder of Ansley Real Estate, Christie's International, an award-winning Atlanta-based real estate broker that did over $3 billion in sales last year.
And I'm Chris Tuff, one of the first advertisers to work directly with Mark Zuckerberg in 2006. I've since gone on to be the best-selling author of The Millennial Whisper and Save Your Asks.
And this is Brokering Billions. This podcast is about uncovering the hustle, perseverance, mindset, and tricks that are used by the top real estate agents of the country to help you take your business to the next level.
In today's episode, we interview Aaron Kerman out of Beverly Hills, California, who just recently joined Christie's International Real Estate. He's one of the top producing agents in the United States with, get this, over $9 billion in luxury home sales. He's listed some of the most sought after homes, and he is the guy that when celebrities list their homes, they go to Aaron and his team. In today's episode, he's going to discuss what it takes to land that dream listing, and he'll even talk about a couple stories from some of these crazy listings that have been over $200 million. So stay tuned for Aaron. There we go.
Oh, yeah, baby.
The one everyone's been waiting for.
Man, I have been so excited for this podcast. I've got a new friend in Beverly Hills, Aaron Kerman. You might know him from Listing Impossible. Just a total superstar. And we're going to dive into his business, what motivates him. And he's just started his own brokerage called AKG Christie's International Real Estate, which is so exciting for me because as a partner in Christie's and having the Christie's franchise in Atlanta, Georgia, it's so awesome to have such a superstar, you know, way out on the West Coast where I was there last weekend watching the Georgia Bulldogs dominate to go back-to-back to win their second national championship.
Here
but I won't
goes.
Talk too much about that, guys. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, man. I love the entry music. Got me all riled up and ready to go.
Aaron, the energy is going to be here. We bring the energy. That is for sure.
I almost want to see you guys do those bobs.
We'll bring it back.
Bring it back. Boom.
Here we go. The first double amp up music we've had.
Let me tell you why we got a double amp up volume. Aaron has done over 10 billion dollars in sales through his career. He did close to 2 billion in sales himself with his team last year in 2022. So just a couple of quick facts just to kind of show you the level of professionalism and the level of skill that this guy Aaron has. He's got 160 plus people so far with his new company that he just kind of came into existence in December of last year. He is inside the top five of luxury real estate agents in the United States by the Wall Street Journal. And we're just excited to see how he does it. I mean, Aaron, what got you first into real estate?
Funny enough, what got me into real estate is I could not hold a job in any other thing. Like I got fired from every job I ever had. Started when I was 15, literally 2 months later, fired. I couldn't hold a waiter job. My dad said, go clean cars, couldn't do that. I realized at a very young age that I needed to be my own boss. And the beauty of real estate was I always loved it ever since I was a kid. And I probably shouldn't tell people this, but I will. When I was like 7, I used to go to the wealthy neighborhood by my bike. By the way, nobody should ever do this and break into these houses, the empty ones. Don't do this, people. Hop over fences that I knew were empty. And I used to either pretend to want to live in the houses or pretend to want to sell them. And I was like 7 and 9 years old.
I love it. I love it. So, okay. So take us through. So take us from the very beginning. So Aaron, you fail in a bunch of stuff. You're like, I don't know what's next. You've always had this yearning. Tell us about how you first landed into real estate and what that looked like. How did you know this was the thing?
Yeah. And let me ask a little differently too. Was it the houses and the beauty and the architecture? Was it the money, or was it being around these people that had these houses? What was the draw?
Probably a little bit of both. I grew up with a very modest family. My mom was a teacher and my dad was in trucking. I lived in this area though that was like modest, but very close to it was like a wealthy neighborhood. And I went to a school that was very diverse. So I was always somewhat surrounded by wealth, even though it wasn't something that I personally had, but I knew it existed. And I loved houses, I loved real estate, and I loved living a good life. I always saw what living a good life was. And it was just something that I always felt like I knew that I wanted. And I'll never forget when I was a kid, I used to make, this is a nightmare for real estate agents. We had torn carpet because my parents were relatively poor. Like they couldn't afford to maintain a house the way we would want to. And I used to say, you know, let's move. And I would pick an agent and I would say, mom, dad, call them and let's go look at houses. And I remember we would drive into these fancy cars with some of the bigger names. And it was my dream to have them move. And it never happened. We were the biggest waste of time, but it was part of, looking back, it was like part of my DNA. And I remember being in these cars that were nice, looking at these gorgeous houses and going, God, I really like this life. I could see that this life could be for me. And it's something that I always wanted. And I never really steered from that goal, even when things didn't go my way.
That's incredible. And then Aaron, so you're growing up in Beverly Hills or in LA?
Oh, I grew up in like the poor neighborhood in the San Fernando Valley. So the world that I know today was not the world that I ever imagined I would be in or had a part of.
I mean, and you talk about hockey stick growth. I mean, just in our preparation for this interview, Aaron, to give you perspective, it seems like the most up-to-date of all your numbers is Instagram, because anywhere else you go, it's like a billion off. Like you're growing so fast that it's almost hard to keep up.
By the way, that drives me crazy and we need to fix it because I don't like it.
It's a good problem.
I have seen some agents and I love a scorecard, right? We've got a scorecard in our Buckhead office, which always has the leaders and their volume and it changes. And I'm sitting there watching the board every week when it changes. Maybe we should all have some sort of count on our website, you know, weekly that changes to say, hey, this many houses under contract this week. This is our volume, you know, just actively keep it. And that can kind of go to the Instagrams and stuff like that.
Well, that's a good or bad thing because, you know, our numbers go up and down depending on how many escrows we're winning or losing every day. So I prefer to keep it general at the end. That's a much cleaner version of where we
rounding up on billions is probably a little bit easier in millions for you as you surpass the 10 billion mark. So, all right. So Aaron, take us back to your first job in real estate when you could look in the mirror. Obviously it seems like you were motivated from the get-go, but you knew that this was it. You knew, was there one instance where you're like, all right, this is what I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing and I'm going to crush.
Well, funny enough, I got fired. It was my first job. I was an intern. I was like 17. I couldn't even hold an intern job that was not paid, by the way. Like I literally was free. To this day, the guy that owns that brokerage, which turned out to be a huge brokerage, was like, God, that fire was the worst mistake I've ever made. So I got fired and there was this really small boutique company at the time. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to work for anybody else. I'm going to dive into being a real estate broker. And I remember I had no money and my parents always had really old cars. And I'll never forget. I said to my parents were divorced at the time. And I said to my mom, and they always had 20-year-old calls. I said, mom, I need a new Mercedes. And she was like, she's never had a Mercedes. She's never had a new Mercedes. But I said, mom, I need a new car. I was 18, 17. And I was like, I need to have the right look, image, and feel. Help me. She took out a loan, got a car, which I'll never forget. So ever since then, I've been buying her cars.
I love it.
And I went to this really boutique company at the time. And I was my own boss. And it was just a very natural experience for me. I stepped in for the first time when I didn't work for somebody else. And I was like, I'm going to do this I'm going to be great and I'm going to make this work. And the second I owned that it was mine was the second that all of my issues, my dyslexia, my ability to not write, because I have severe dyslexia, I can't write. I had challenges reading. All of that stuff, I just honed in and I was super careful with everything I did. And it was when I started to flourish.
Mm. That is so inspiring. So I take it that you just went into real estate, forewent college, correct?
Yeah. I put myself through college selling real estate. And I was a horrible college student because I was much more dedicated to real estate than I was college. So I missed half the classes. I don't even know how I passed, to be honest. But yeah, I was like selling real estate, working, and I was in this world and I was young. Like I was 17, I was 18, I was 19. And it was hard to get people to take me seriously, but somehow I sort of found my little niche and I started to roll. And by the way, there weren't these houses that you see me selling today. They were like modest, normal priced homes in the San Fernando Valley.
You know, what's interesting, listeners, is through all of our podcasts, there's some themes that keep coming out. One is finding your way, the way that you want to do it. You know, Aaron's dyslexic. I'm incredibly dyslexic. As you guys know, I've probably read less than 5 books. I listen to books now.
By the way, you and I both, we're similar.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't read and write.
I love listening to books now, but go on.
Yeah,
I do too. And don't read and write, but you've got into a position because you're passionate about what you wanted to do. And you started building that life around that. And that's so inspiring because look at you today with your own company, right? You're not working for anybody else. You're going to build your company the way you want to do it. You've got a fascinating brand behind it with Christie's, which is awesome. And here you are. I mean, I just think that is so incredibly cool. Tell us a story about maybe your most exciting sale. I mean, was it the Danny Thomas estate?
Happened last year. It was actually the one which ended up selling for $141 million. No, $145 million. And it was the one, and it was this wild roller coaster of a moment. You know, I'd been working on it. You know, funny enough, the developer that built the house really wasn't like the biggest fan of mine. It was a whole complicated situation. And long story short, I became friends with, you know, his wife who was, and, you know, at one point I was like, there's no way I'm going to get hired on this house just because the guy that had built it really didn't love me for multiple reasons and you know, just historical. And then, you know, all I can tell you is we got hired and not hired 4 times because, the house went into conservatorship, courts, trustees. I remember we had worked on getting a trustee hired because, you know, the developer was making a bunch of interesting moves that weren't working. That trustee fired us. So literally we got hired and fired no less than 3 times before we started on a $200 million listing. We launched it at 225, I think. We got hired 4 times, fired 4 times. I don't get emotional about winning or losing deals. Like, you know, for me, it's just part of the game. You win, you lose. I look at it like a board chess. That time I was like looking at it, and my lovely husband was very sweet. He's like, look, if it's meant to be, it'll be. Walk away, move on. And I took his advice. I did. We heard a new trustee came to the table and I had partners on the deal. And I said, listen, let's call him. Usually trustees never go with historical agents because they want their own team. They want to be in control and there's too much history. And so I called my partners. I said, there is no way we're going to get this, but we need to try. So we called the trustee. We said, look, hire us, don't hire us. We have a lot of information on the house. Please take a meeting. At minimum, you'll learn. And at maximum, you'll love us. And we took a meeting and we planned and we plotted. I said to my partners, don't talk about the history. Don't, because there was just so much history. This project has been being built for 10 years. My partners were on it for 5. I said, don't go into any of that. The first thing the trustee says is, tell us the history. And and it just all came out. But we did we did what we did. We pitched and sure enough, he hired us. And he was the guy that ultimately helped us and helped the entire situation get solved and sold.
That's an incredible story. We get into the details here relative to the pitch, right? And we've talked a lot about how to win listings. We've got some agents here that are just starting out, Aaron. And, you know, for a big listing like that, you know, what did you do differently? I mean, you know, did you come in on a helicopter? How did you make your entrance? How did you get their attention? I know you went through the history and all the stuff, but what was a couple things that you really thought about and did differently to win that deal?
It's different strokes for different folks, right? So what works for me may not work for somebody else. And that's the beauty of our job. Everyone has a different way and philosophy, and everyone's way is right. It's just a matter of finding your people, right? For me, the funny thing is I've had listings at 500 million. This one was 200 million. I sold one of the most expensive houses in Europe and at 300 million. And the basis for my big ones have always just been connect to the seller, connect to what they're trying to do, and keep it simple. So I really remembered I was up for one of the most expensive listings in America. At the time, it was $500 million. Everybody brought all these big books and done what they're going to do. And I was like, I brought one page. I literally brought a one piece paper. I said, look, at this price point, there are 3,862 billionaires in the world-ish. These are your buyers. Of those billionaires, I can get to no less than 100. Hire me. And that was enough.
Wow. Brilliant. Okay, so I've got a question on that big sale last year. What was the first thing that you did to celebrate that? Was it like dinner? Was it like, or was there anything ridiculous? I mean,
or was it get
just
to work?
Like, yeah, get nothing, back to work. Nothing,
I don't celebrate sales. It's probably bad, but I don't celebrate sales because for me, we're only as good as our last sale.
Sure.
So I love selling. It's funny because we love to make money on sales. We love to get them off the books. We love to make our clients happy. I always feel the sense of sadness too, because it's like, I no longer have that to work on. It's like, I don't have my marketing. I don't have my advertising. What is my replacement? And by the way, that's a hard replacement to sell a $200 million house. You know, that's what we're going to call a lifetime listing that you only get every so often.
Sure.
And so it's like, I love selling them. I'm happy, but I'm also kind of sad because it's like, I don't get to market it. I don't get to advertise it. All the excitement that comes with marketing and advertising and infrastructure and the people you meet, that comes to an end and you need to get to your next beginning. So I never really celebrate my sales.
Yeah, I mean, Bonneau is very similar, right? And we talk a lot, and I've heard it in some of your interviews, managing this thing between patience and impatience. Can you tell listeners how you do that? Because you're typically a fairly impatient person, I would guess, like Bonneau, from what we've heard. So,
well, all of our guests.
Most.
Yeah, I struggle with it because I am so impatient. And I believe I want Rome to be built overnight. Like I want it. I don't love process. Like, but the process is important. And that's why we are where we are, but I hate it. And so I'm happy in life. Like I work on happiness and making sure I'm happy, but I'm never exactly happy with where I am in business because I have so many other agendas and so many places to want to go that like, I'm always looking forward. I never look back. I'm always like 10 steps ahead of where my last step was. And being impatient, I notice can lead to irritation and aggravation because if I'm not liking where I am, I have to really regulate myself and say, it's going to come, be patient, chill. Let's get the steps that we need to do to accomplish the goal. And what I learned was as long as I see steps forward, it's a great way to manage my impatience. If I'm not seeing the right steps, and they could even be baby steps. You know, if I want to get a wall painted, paint half the wall, give me a color sample. Let me see what's going to happen to know that we're going in the right direction. I'm usually manageably okay. Where I know I get frustrated is if things are just not happening, it's too slow, I see no movement, and then I really have to work on my patience and my mood, which is why I meditate every day.
Well, that's great. Well, I think impatience done the right way is a good gift to have, right? And I think under management of that impatience is a good thing. I remember, Aaron, my first kind of big listing that got publicity and things like that, that kind of took me to that next level. I don't know if that was 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but it was a great house. A baseball player got traded and I got the listing and, you know, a lot of press and everything else. And we sold it. And that kind of put me in another sphere. Do you remember, you know, you started this business when you were 17, 18 years old. Do you remember that one listing? And I don't know if you were 20 or 25 or whenever, when that happened, what was it? And then how did you use that to take you to the next level?
I never had that. So my experience was a much more gradual experience. I built a niche at the time, and my niche was like, we called it architecture, selling. And basically I started selling really cool houses. And people started to know me as the guy that sold cool houses. And sometimes that was like more significant, like architects, John Lautner, Neutra, Schindler, Frank Gehry's. Sometimes it was just interesting. But I started doubling down on those houses over and over again. And I remember being a little frustrated because people started to know me as that, but it wasn't like mass market. And I remember getting frustrated because they weren't writing about it the way I wanted them to. And so I spent, one of the things I did was I remember spending like $7,000 for a PR newswire. And I was like, well, if they're not going to write about me, I'll write about myself. So I literally started like being like celebrity agent, Aaron Kerman list, boom, power broker. I mean, I inundated that PR newswire. Like, and I basically built my own branding machine, and eventually people took notice, and now, you know, we don't have to necessarily write about ourselves. People are writing about us. But I will tell you, it's funny because the Wall Street Journal will write a story about either me, a house, a seller, and I'll have my team write a PR newswire about something. And every time the PR newswire goes to the top, it's actually stronger than legitimate, amazing press opportunities, and it lasts longer. And I think the beauty of today's world is you don't need to have a show. You don't need to be famous because you can literally do it yourself with social medias, publicity, newswires. And that's the beauty of what we do today in today's moment.
Well, you've got, you know, almost 400,000 followers on Instagram, which is an absurd number. When you got the call for Listing Impossible, how has that impacted your business? Do you recommend that if you get that opportunity for other agents to be on a show? You seem to be a natural on camera here, obviously. How has that impacted and did you love that experience?
So let's go back. I didn't get the call. I made that happen.
I love it. Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
Yes.
Yeah, I pitched it. I met with 10 production companies. I got 20 denials. No one wanted to go. Eventually I got it. I got it sold. My TV experience was a little different than the other, than my, because we're all in the same world and we're all friends. The current agents that are on TV built their businesses on TV. So they had used TV to build a brand, an image, a look, a feel, and make a tremendous amount of money. The variation to me was I had already had a brand, a business, money in the bank. So to be really honest, when I shot TV, I lost about $3.6 million that year. Like I lost almost four. Wow. Because I didn't have the time. Like people were calling me to list houses and I'm like, can you meet on Wednesday at 5? And I'll be like, you know, unfortunately I can't. I can meet on Sunday at 10 and it was too late. Mm-hmm. So I would say TV is great. I had a lot of fun doing it. I would do it again, but in a different format, because for me, running a business, making money, and living the life that I want to live is more important than just being on TV. And, you know, I'm still getting a lot of TV opportunities, but I'm very cautious with moving forward on them because I have other agenda goals that I feel like, you know, shooting at this very moment in time would derail.
Well, that's interesting. So I'd love to jump now into Christie's, the Christie's partnership. You know, that's really, really new and fresh for you. Walk us through why this was a no-brainer for you to go to this brand that you and I are both part of.
I loved Christie's. I worked with the brand for the one of the best part of my career is when it was originally at Hilton and Highland, which, you know, has had a different moment right now. But I've loved the brand ever since I worked for it. I love the name. I love the brand. I love the international components. I love the auction house. And it just felt like a supernatural fit for us from day one. And I, you know, was tired of working at other people's brokerages. I was tired of being part of something that no longer felt like me. Even though we are independent contractors and we run our own businesses, I think at the end of the day, I just got tired of it not being something that I create culturally, visually. I could have opened AKG standalone. We already had the infrastructure. We already had the staff, but I wanted to be something bigger than myself. And I wanted to give my agents the best position to get as many listings as they can, get as many buyers as they can. And I just feel like the brokerage business is bigger than boutique right now. And that international, national component, that ability to partner with the world's most amazing and number one auction house is really critical. It's really important. And it made me feel very comfortable in opening my own brokerage. There was not a single moment where I said, this is not going to work.
You know, that's the exact same reason why we did it in Atlanta. We had a great local shop, Ansley Real Estate, but adding that Christie's International to it just put us in a whole different sphere, right? And then being able to use the proprietary technology, everybody says they're a tech company, you know, this, that, or the other, and they've got the best thing. Well, at the end of the day, Christie's really does have the best tech platform, you know, called Platform. And we run our whole business through that. And it is really for the agents. Everything that I decide to do in Georgia for our age is all for the agents, right? And having that technical side, the technology for them to run their deal management system and then their client management system all through one solid, you know, system is absolutely amazing for us.
And well, it's millions of dollars to create. Like, I did a tech platform following something else. This was before I opened up our brokerage. And that tech is so critical because every step that we can make that can make our agents more productive and win more is a step in the right direction. And I got to tell you, I love the ownership of Christie's. I love the management. I love the name. I love the brand. And I feel like for people like us, we're so lucky to have been able to be part of that, because it's like, for me, I feel like the sky's the limit. And I feel very, not only comfortable, but just safe with the movements that they've been able to help with.
Well, that's a good word, safe. And I feel so fortunate to have counterparts like you all over the country. And I'm so excited to go to our, you know, Christie's owners conference at the Cayman Islands here in the next month or two to, you know, brainstorm with other independent owners like me and like you all across the country. And just that brain trust is so important, because I've never really had a partner, and being able to partner with other guys and companies, you know, across the country with this Christie's that ties us together is absolutely amazing.
I'm a big fan of partnership. I don't like to do anything by myself because I find it lonely. And I like to overanalyze everything. So I like to talk everything out, good, bad, ugly, what's going to happen. And I need a partner to do that. And so, like, I just, like you said, I can't wait to get to that Christie's conference because we're all in it together, right? And as a team, teams are so much stronger together than not. And so, That understanding of what you're going through, how to get bigger, how to get better, how to relate to our agents better, how to relate to our opponents even, are ways that all bring us together.
Yeah, what works in Atlanta or Dallas, you might pick something that I'm doing well that you might want to take, and vice versa. And it's been really, really good. So going back to the team aspect, right? When I started, I was an individual agent. So were you, right? In a certain point, you said, golly, I can be doing so much more with some help. And I said the same thing. what are the attributes of having a team for the people that are just starting out? How do you run your team? Because what we do is we like to dive into, you know, how does your team actually operate? You know, if you could walk us through that, that'd be very helpful.
I mean, the team was such a learning experience for me because I had pitched to, at the time it was John Aero Group or Pacific Union, my company. I was like, I want to run a team and I want to get a space. So I all of a sudden had a 5,000 square foot office and I had no team. And so then I had a manager and said, let's recruit. So we got 50 people within 3 weeks because a lot of people wanted to work under our brand. Wow. And a year later, we made no money. And I was spending money that I didn't have to spend before. And I was losing money. And I looked at my manager. I said, oh, this team is not working. I don't like it. I'm like, where's my money going? And we realized bigger isn't better. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way, right? But from mistakes, you learn. And what we learned is, A, teams are not for everybody. So not everybody should jump on the team bandwagon. You have to have a certain level of business to be able to provide for your team and vice versa. People need to diversify what they're good at and what they're not good at and really understand that to be a great team leader. And at the end of the day, once you have a team, you have a business, you have a brand. And anything that American Airlines, Delta, or any other Fortune 500 company is doing is something that you need to be doing for your team. So it's a lot of risk. It's a lot of liability, but the beauty is it's a lot of reward. I would say it was probably one of my most fun. I loved building a team. I love building a brokerage because it's challenging. It's not easy, but it's so much fun. And at a certain point, you know, we know what we know. We are experts at what we know. I've done what I've done since I was, you know, 17, 26 years, I think. So I love to give back to people. I love to teach. I love to watch my team's success. And what we really love to see, and this is the beauty of what we're running right now, is we have guys that are like 22 and girls that are 22, 23. They can't get the $15 or $20 million listing, but they're really good at getting leads. And they're bringing it to senior members of our team that are good at closing those leads. And it's like a win-win because today's world, A, there's so much to what we do, media, TV, press, technology, just selling houses, the basics, the new. And then on top of it, I don't believe we have clients anymore. Like, when I started, I was like, that's my client. And it was my client. Today, I don't have a client. If I'm not in front of my client's face at the right time, at the right moment, they are gone because there are so many agents. Agents are so hungry for business. Teams are so out there getting business that people are going to go with who's at the face, who's in front of their face at the right time at the right moment. Or if you have a niche, they're going to interview the top five people in the niche and go after those people anyway. So the world has changed. And without a good team, it's hard to compete.
And it's hard to be a superstar agent because, Aaron, you only do what you're really, really good at. And you have outsourced the things that you're not good at that are part of your team. You know, I doubt that you write contracts. I doubt that you do the Excel spreadsheets to show when the escrows. I don't do any of that stuff either. And because I'm not good at it, not because I don't want to do it.
I used to hate organization and structure. Like, and running a team, you're like, no, it's all about structure, organization, systems, and monitoring those systems. Because at the end of the day, real estate's mathematical. If you want to sell $1 billion, how many leads do you have to call to sell that? It's a very simple formula. Whether you're good or bad, we have bad agents that are very successful too. Like they just are, right? And so once you figure out the formulaic approach to the business, to running teams, is when people get successful. And I had to force myself to really dive a little deeper into the management side of life than I would have liked. Because at the end of the day, I know what I'm good at. I'm an amazing salesperson that's great at getting listing and selling houses. That's my je ne sais quoi. Everything else, I have to work at.
Well, I would go on a limb and say, I mean, you're probably one of the world's greatest salespeople, right? To get these listings, you have got to be one of the best to be in the competitive market and be dominating the way that you are, Aaron. You are one of the world's best salespeople, right? And I know you do training and you've got to have something. So I want to know, I'm obsessed with relationships and connection, right? And one of the things that as I interview more and more people like you across industries is this theme that, you know, creating relationships is fairly easy. It's sustaining and deepening them, especially when someone's about to buy a house or list a house. That's where the money is, right? So talk to us about your single favorite tactic that you have taught others that listeners can glean from this interview. What's that one tactic that you've used to get you where you are?
Listening. There is, I don't like the word salesman, saleswoman. I kind of hate, because here's the deal. Most people don't want to be handled. I don't want to be handled. I don't want to be, I appreciate a good salesperson, but I don't want to feel like you're selling. And if I feel like you're selling, I'm going to want to write from you, because I'm in a very privileged position in that now a lot of people sell me a lot of stuff, right? Because I have access. So every day that access, not only am I working on, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still you know, a third party transactions, right? But I'm also a principal to a lot. And so I'm around a lot of people that do a lot of stuff. And what I realize is people don't want to be handled. People don't want to be sold. They want to be understood. And so the best way to do that is to sit down and listen and then make a really exquisite approach to what we do. Some of my biggest listings, I'll never forget. I had a $100 million listing. We were at a formal table because this is a very high profile, multi-billionaire that had business manager. Just so happened, somehow energy came up and she had mentioned her psychic that she used, who happens to be my psychic. So it was a weird fluke. So I'll never forget, we're sitting on opposite sides of the table with literally there were like five people on this side, all part of a team to discuss who's going to get this $100 million listing. The whole time I talked about our psychic. Literally, that's all we talked about. 45 minutes. I looked at my clock. I'm like, okay, we have 5 more minutes. I looked, I said, here's the plan. A, B, C, D. But because she was so comfortable with me as a human, the next day I had the signed listing agreement. I don't think those business managers even knew what was going on. I don't know if they agreed with me getting the listing, you know, but we made a human connection. And so my advice to anybody day in and day out is bring your materials, bring who you are, what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. But it's not going to work if you don't have a human connection. So start with that and work backwards. And sometimes most of my listing appointments, I'm just going to be honest, this is where building your own brand and your own name and your reputation helps. I don't have to sell anymore. Mm-hmm. I come in, most of my appointments are about getting to know somebody, having them get to know about me, and then doing what I do. The beauty of that, though, is it takes time to get there because I'm so, like, when you need a listing, when you want a listing, when you're not confident that you're the best, you're not the best. Once you know that you could stand by everything you say and you're the most knowledgeable in your neighborhood, you have the best marketing approach, you know the sellers, I could come in there. Nothing's going to really slip by me because I'm aware of what's going on. And that education and that knowledge helps. And it's not just real estate. And this is what I always tell people. Study your market. Study real estate. Study the world. Read the Wall Street Journal every day. I have it on my desk. Like, I want to know what's happening out there so I can talk about it. You know, if you can afford to, travel, stay at great hotels. If you can afford to, dine at restaurants that your clients are dining at. Because that's how you're going to understand them. That's how they're going to understand you. That's going to make for a deeper connection. And that's how you ultimately sell. And the last point is I always tell people, find your people. Because I'm not going to be for everybody. Some people are going to hate me. Some people are not going to like me. It's just not going to. But once you find the people that do, those are the ones that will hire you every time. And that takes a lot of self-identity to be able to do.
I mean, spoken from true real estate genius. That's absolutely phenomenal. We're going to end with that incredible words of wisdom. You know, Aaron, these listeners are going to want to find you. What's the best thing where they can learn about you more? And is there anything you'd like to promote to the listeners out here?
No, we just like to, we like to talk to guys like you, have fun, share our knowledge. You know, I'm highly Googleable. You know, so Google my name, go to my website, aaronkerman.com, go to my Instagram, aaronkerman. Make sure you're Googleable. Make sure that people know that you're the expert, because the first thing people are going to do is check up on you online. And if you have a great footprint, it makes the interviews, it makes the sale so much easier, because you actually don't have to do much. They already know who you are. They already know what you do. So you literally can just go in and be yourself and actually have a great conversation and be done.
Absolutely amazing. Aaron, you are the man. This has been an unbelievable interview. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah. And this is Chris Tuff.
Bonneau Ansley signing off.
Brokering billions, baby. Thank you, Aaron.
Bye, guys. Thanks for having me.